meeting to order right now. And before we begin, I have a couple of housekeeping points. First is just a clarification on the rules for the committee. There was a question of whether the amendments had to be filed both electronically and in person. It's one or the other that we want to accept. We just want to have an idea of where things are going there. And then as it gets closer to deadline, we know that things kind of pile up. So when it gets close to that crunch time, we'll be a little bit more lenient with having it in person, as long as we know about it ahead of time and have that it's been brought to House Research before then, we'll accept that as we go forward. So just wanted to clarify that up a little bit. And also in your folders today, Representative Mason last week asked a question regarding the nursing facility level of care, and there is a written answer from Ms. Pinelli in our folders today to explain some of that. So are there any questions on those two points? All right.
Thank you.
Thanks. Well, then, to begin this morning, we will approve the minutes. Is there a motion to approve the minutes? Representative Christensen moves to approve today's minutes. Any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? Minutes are approved. All right. Now this morning we have, to begin, an overview of nursing facilities and Medicaid payment rates in the state. And we have with us this morning Assistant Commissioner Lauren Coleman and Bob Held. So whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lauren Coleman. I am the Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Human Services. I'm responsible for aging and adult services and nursing facilities rates and policy. I know we're here primarily today to discuss nursing facility rates. Bob will present that information shortly. But before that, I want to talk more broadly about long-term services and supports both in and outside of nursing facilities. Minnesota has much to be proud of in our services for seniors and for people with disabilities. Minnesota is a national leader for services and supports, and recently has once again been rated number one by the AARP with funding from the SCAN Foundation in our in their scorecard. We were the only state that was able to achieve a top score in the top 25 percentile of all five domains that were measured in their scorecard: affordability and access, choice of setting and provider, quality of life and quality of care, support for family caregivers, and effective transitions. Minnesota also ranked first when the scorecard was originally produced in 2011. We have been committed as a state to consumer information and empowerment. The Linkage Line, Senior Linkage Line, Disability Linkage Line, Veterans Linkage Line, MinnesotaHelp.info through the Minnesota Board on Aging are examples of this important resource in Minnesota. Another way we have done this is by measuring what is important and getting that information about the quality of our care systems to consumers and their families so they are empowered to make informed decisions about their care. Bob Held will be talking in brief about the nursing facility information available through the Minnesota Nursing Facility Report Card. I wanted to mention that we are building a similar type system for our home and community-based service system, including assisted living, using the lessons we have learned from nursing facilities. We've also focused efforts on enhancing the long-term care consultation process to get consumers the information about the breadth of long-term services and supports available in Minnesota. These tools are available when consumers request it to make good choices at the local level. We didn't build this nation-leading system alone. Minnesota has long had the support of policymakers, dedicated providers, and industry workers in finding innovative ways to continuously improve the system. Quality, and more specifically, quality of life, is always part of our agenda. We have a working relationship and partnership with the provider community. We've had an ongoing discussion of what would the future care center look like, what will seniors want in the future for long-term services and supports. And similarly, we have had an open conversation about payment system reform options. We have found common ground in focusing on efforts to improve the quality of our system. One example is the Nursing Facility PIP program, the Performance-Based Incentive Payments. The program allows nursing facilities to contract with the department to earn performance incentive payments based upon outcomes of up to 5% of their operating rate. This program has allowed facilities to learn from each other on what programs have been successful to improve the quality in their own facilities. Like the report card, we are in the process of implementing a similar program in the home and community-based services system, applying what we have learned in nursing facilities to the other portions of our long-term service system. Lastly, recent rate increases have used a portion of the increase to reward performance in facilities and in our home and community-based service programs as part of the 5% rate increase that passed the last 2 years. The age wave is here. As you've learned from the state demographer last week, we are entering the early stages of the boomer age wave. This will bring new challenges and opportunities to our long-term care system. Collectively, we will be challenged as a state as we have never been so in history. I look forward to discussing long-term care financing when the committee, which the committee has also expressed a strong interest at a later date. And with that, I'll turn the program over to Bob Held.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Bob Held, Division Director for Nursing Facility Rates and Policy at DHS, and I was asked to talk about the nursing facility Medicaid payment rates, and will also provide a little bit of background about nursing facilities. I'm going to talk about quality, I'm going to talk about some financial matters, and rebalancing. So, to give you some real basic information, we have 367 nursing homes in Minnesota, just under 30,000 beds, that participate in the Medicaid program. We also have 17 additional facilities, and that includes, I believe, five homes that are part of the Minnesota Veterans Homes, for a total of 31,140 beds. We have three types of facilities, and I'm showing just two of them here, hospital-attached and freestanding. The freestanding actually includes nursing homes and boarding care homes. There's about 11 boarding care homes. But 55 of our nursing homes are hospital-attached. And by ownership type, you can see that about 71% of our nursing homes are not-for-profit or government-owned. 29% are for-profit nursing homes. We have, of the 367, almost half are not affiliated, meaning they're not part of a chain of any sort. They're just basically single nursing homes. We also have 33 homes that are affiliated in groups of two or three, 43 in groups of four to eight, and then 126, so that's almost our largest group, that are fairly large chains of nine or more. This actually should say geographic peer groups, and you can see them shown color-coded. 191 are in the metro area, which includes the Twin Cities, but goes all the way up to Morrison County, all the way down to Winona, and includes St. Louis and Carlson County. These are the categorizations that are in current statute that we would use for most any kind of categorization. Occupancy rates. It looks a little bit like a roller coaster, but in fact, the current occupancy rates are the lowest that we've seen on record in the state. It doesn't show 2013 on the table, but the 2013 statistic is 89.4%. And what's ironic is that the number of admissions are going up. So how do we explain that? And between the two of them, we actually see it as a rather positive trend, though the low admission, I think, creates a bit of a financial hardship for nursing homes. Probably they would challenge my use of the phrase a bit of. But what's happening is that nursing homes are doing increasing amounts of short stay, and so what we're seeing is more and more people admitted, and more of them are returning to their homes. As you see, the length of stay has been going down. We've been unable to compile this data for the last few years, but the trend, particularly for the median, has been going down, so I wouldn't be surprised if it were around 25 days now, meaning half of all admissions stay for 25 days or less. We've had a pattern of facility closures going on for a long, long time. And interestingly, while it again looks a bit like a roller coaster, the number of facility closures appears to be on a somewhat downward trend. What types of beds are there in nursing homes? How many of them are in shared rooms? Well, a single room means that you don't share the bedroom with anybody, but you do not have your own private bathroom. And a private room means that you have a single that also has its own bathroom that's not shared. So we've got 47% of our beds that are in single or private rooms. Split doubles are somewhat similar to that. And then the majority of beds, or the, I guess, plurality, would be in semi-private or two-bedrooms. We only have 1% of our beds in rooms that have three or four beds. The portion of beds in single bedrooms, meaning single and private, has nearly doubled in the last decade. We're at 47, it was only 26%, so it's been a steady pattern of increase. What is the payer mix? Who pays for the resident days that are provided by nursing homes? The biggest payer is Medicaid, 55.9%, and private pay is the second biggest. I would note that Medicaid, when we set rates that are paid for by Medicaid, that we're also setting the rates that apply to private pay residents. A facility cannot charge their private paying person less than the rate we set for Medicaid. If they do, well, they can, but if they do, we will then take that rate as the Medicaid rate. We will pay either what their rate is that we establish or their charges, whichever is less. At the same time, nursing facilities cannot charge private paying people more than the rate we set, and that's under the rate equalization law, which is a Minnesota law. And so while we only pay for 56% of the days, we're setting the rates for about 91 or 92% of the days. However, rate equalization does have an exception for single bedrooms. And as you can see, with 26% of our resident days being private pay and 47% of our beds being making that exception available, there's a great many private paying people who would be in a single bedroom and paying more than the Medicaid rate. In addition, Medicaid will pay under certain circumstances for a private room when there's medical necessity for it. So rates. This is a bit of a data-rich table, but what we're trying to show on this, and we've got four metro, four non-metro facilities, we've got a mix of for-profit, non-profit, and government, is that for a specific RUGS class, and I'll talk a little bit more. Well, RUGS is resource utilization groups, and it's a case-based classification system, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. But these are the rates in eight different facilities for the same RUG class. So you look at this, and you'll note that for that same level of care, we're paying as little as $138 and as much as $230. You'll also notice when you look at the quality scores that there doesn't appear to be much relationship between the quality score and the rate, that we have high-rate facilities with high quality scores and low-rate facilities with high quality scores, and vice versa. We have low quality scores associated with both high and low rates. A PC1, by the way, is a individual with moderate physical dependencies and little or no restorative nursing. So I showed you the rates for the, you know, kind of give you a sense of the range for the PC1, but in fact each nursing home has 50 rates that we set. 50 rates for 367 nursing homes means that we actually set roughly 16,000-18,000 rates. And why do we do that? Why do we adjust for case mix? Why do we pay more for one person, less for another? Well, we're adjusting for acuity. Some people have much more intense needs than other people. We're adjusting for the resources that are needed to care for individuals that have different resource needs. And we're considering a financial incentive there. And the financial incentive is that if we paid the same rate for everybody, there would be an interest on the part of many providers in admitting people who required less resources and had lower acuity. If you want nursing facilities to admit people with higher acuity needs, then you have to make it possible for them to do so. You can't just pay the average rate and say, eh, on average, you admit the average person. That's not going to work out that way. So it creates a financial incentive to essentially neutralize the incentive to admit low-need people in favor of admitting people who just need to be cared for. Why do we, or how do we adjust for case mix? We use a federally designed system. It's called RUGs, Resource Utilization Groups, and it's a choice Minnesota made a little over a decade ago to use that system. Prior to that, we did case mix. We had 11 groups, a Minnesota designed system. It required each nursing home to do a separate assessment for each individual on a semi-annual basis. Once it was done by the state, the next time it's done by the facility, and so on. The federal government at the same time was requiring facilities to complete a federally mandated assessment on a federally mandated timeline. That's an assessment called the MDS, the minimum data set. So at the point in time prior to our adoption of RUGs, we were requiring, between us and the federal government, we were requiring facilities to do two assessments. There were probably about 100,000 state-mandated assessments being done a year at a substantial cost for each one. They were done by an RN. And it was a problem. We were trying to figure out how to get away from that. We worked collaboratively with stakeholders and decided to adopt the RUG system. So that system is now what we're using. It provides the 50 groups. That system is very intensively researched. It gives the best explanation of variation between needs of people based on assessment of the systems that are available, and it minimizes the burden on facilities by removing that additional assessment. Those assessments are required every 90 days, and every 90 days when we get a new assessment, we assign a new classification to each resident in the program. What are the average rates? Rates are divided into three main categories: operating, external fixed, and property. The total average operating rate is $179.72. So let's just say $180. The operating portion of that is $145 and change. That consists of three components: a direct care component, which is case mix adjusted under the RUG system, and that's 54% of the operating; an other care-related component; and an other operating. Other operating consists of things like administration, maintenance, housekeeping, laundry, dietary. External fixed, I won't read the long list of components that are in there, but they're basically recomputed on an annual basis based on what's in the statute, how it says how to compute them. Property average rate is $17, and that gets adjusted whenever there's a major construction project that's completed. And then for private paying people, the average additional charge for a single bedroom is $23.76 per day. So you saw in an earlier chart that nursing homes have different rates, and I explained why within a nursing home there's 50 different rates and why that's an important thing to be doing. But why is it that between nursing homes there are different rates? Well, it's kind of an artifact of the history of how nursing home rates have been set. Beginning in 85, so we're going back 30 years, the state adopted a cost-based system, which in fact replaced a previous cost-based system. The one adopted in 85 was called Rule 49, and it had geographic groups. There were three of them. They weren't quite the same as the ones I showed you. And each of those geographic groups set a limit for, or the state set a limit for costs for each geographic group and facility type. I believe facility type was part of that. Based on a statistical measure of actual spending within that group of facilities. In the late 1990s, during a financial crisis, the state adopted what was called the Alternative Payment System, APS, method, and that was a rate-on-rate method. And what that means is that under APS, we would just simply take a facility's rate, and annually we would apply an inflation factor to it unless the legislature directed us to do otherwise. So it was a voluntary system initially. It was actually quite competitive, but over several years everybody migrated into the APS system, and so once they got in it, we were simply updating their rates annually per inflation or direction from the legislature. So why do facilities have different rates today, even for the same case mix class? It's because when they were last in the cost-based system and their rates were based on their actual costs as limited, their costs were different. In other words, more simply stated, today we pay facilities differently because roughly 20 years ago their costs were different. How's the industry performing financially? This is a line graph showing a trend from 2008, the first time we did this analysis, through 2013. The 2013 data is preliminary data. It's split into all facilities, the green line, the blue line hovering around $50 to $60 million per year losses is the cumulative financial performance of the 55 hospital attached facilities, and the orange line is the freestanding and board and care facilities making as much as about $65-68 million a year to the most recent year, where they're cumulatively all of the freestanding facilities are losing a few million dollars in 2013, which combined with the hospital attached facilities means that the industry overall lost about $55 million in 2013. We have this split out by geographic peer group. You can see that peer group one, which is Metro, for most of the history of compiling this data, did quite a bit better than the other two peer groups. By 2013, there's still a little bit of money being made in Metro, and just a teeny bit made in the semi-rural, but deep rural is losing about $5 million. This, by the way, is looking only at the freestanding facilities. We took out the hospital attached for this analysis and the next one, feeling that the overall performance pretty much tells you the story of the hospital attached facilities. They're not doing too well. So this is just looking at the freestanding by for-profit versus not-for-profit and government. The not-for-profit was cumulatively doing the best up until the last couple of years, but keep in mind there's a lot more of them. and the and this is cumulative gains or losses, so it's not on a per resident day or per facility basis. We have that data, but I felt like I could only show so much information in 45 minutes. I want to talk a little bit about quality. The first thing we did to try to address this issue, from Minnesota has a very robust regulatory system for addressing quality. It's mostly a federally designed system, but there's also state licensure rules. And as a purchaser, DHS felt that we really wanted to use our role in purchasing nursing home care the same way all of us do when we purchase anything. We wanted to think about not just how much we were paying for the services that were provided, but we wanted to think about the quality of what we were getting. And we wanted to use the purchaser role to encourage improvement in quality. So in developing quality measures, there's a few things that immediately come to mind that you want to consider. What are the measures of quality that would be important to a nursing home and to the consumers of a nursing home? What aspects can we actually measure? Can we measure them objectively, reliably, accurately? We wanted measures of quality that were relatively efficient. I didn't want to have to come to the legislature and say, okay, we're going to measure quality, but this is going to cost you $40 million for this quality measure. These are the measures that we have are actually very, very efficient. And we wanted quality measures that are actionable so that a nursing home looking at it or a consumer considering placement in a nursing home could make decisions based on that. The provider can look at those quality measures and say, gee, we thought we were doing well in this area, but we're not doing as well as we thought, and we need to work on that area. So those are the things that we were looking at in designing these. What are the quality measures that are in our system? Currently, we have clinical quality, the Minnesota quality indicators. They're based on that MDS, the assessment that I referred to earlier. We can use change in assessed data to as a or prevalence of certain types of conditions as measures of quality or indicators of quality. Quality of life and resident satisfaction. We conduct face-to-face interviews every year with approximately 13,000 nursing home residents, a sample, in every nursing home in the Medicaid program. Regulatory compliance. This is an efficient measure. The health department's already going out and inspecting. What are they finding? Are they finding people being harmed or not being harmed? And that's the kind of the driving force between how behind how we score regulatory compliance. Staffing. How much staff do they have? How long are direct care staff retained? Are they from the beginning of the reporting year to the end of the year? What portion of the people there on day one are still there on the last day of the reporting year? How much do they use outside nursing pool staff, supplemental nursing service agencies? And finally, a rather crude measure of environment, the percent of beds in single bedrooms. This is a sample report card. This is a real report card. I didn't include the name of the facility. You'll notice they've got a ton of stars, and they've got a comparison on here to the Minnesota average. So, for example, in the first data column, resident quality of life, you'll see the statewide average score is 82.7 out of 100. This facility's score on their most recent quality of life interviews was 87.8, which is quite remarkable. On the quality indicators, they're 4 stars. 3 would be considered sort of average. And you can see from the data, they're well above average. On the upper right, you see a little sign. It's actually a button. It's a number, arrow, star. And when you click on that, it moves you back and forth between just showing the stars, which is the most readily accessible to a report card user, to giving you this drill down data so you can actually see the numbers. When we updated this report card a couple years ago, we also added a drill down feature on quality of life. showing each of the domains and how the facilities score compares to statewide average and how they rank. So actually, I didn't do this on purpose, but this is the facility that had that scored number one. They had the highest score out of the 374 facilities in the report card on their overall score, and ranked very high on many, many of their other measures. We also added a drill-down feature for quality indicators showing the facility and state scores and how they ranked on each of the domains in the QIs.
Mr. Held?
Yes.
I think we have a question from Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Held, going back a couple of PowerPoint slides here, I was wondering about the direct care staff retention. If you could elaborate a little bit on that. I'm curious as to the last few years what the retention rate has been in kind of the overall mix, if you will. And I guess I'm more thinking of more rural where there's more competition, it seems like, for keeping staff in the nursing facilities longer. And I'm just kind of curious, have you got any graphs that are showing what's happened over the last maybe 5 years of staffing retention? That's the number I want to see expanded, if you have any information.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't have that information with me. I think we can pull that together for you. What I can tell you is that staff retention was running around 70%, and that's just direct care staff, so it's nurses, nursing assistants, and primarily. And it went up during the recession, and there was less competition, and so it went all the way up to about 72%, and it's now gone down a couple points. Had I not had this in front of me showing 69.6%, I'd have said, well, it's about 67%. So we're running around 70% retention. I don't have a breakdown by geographic area, but if you go to the report card, and I have a link to it somewhere in here, I thought, in your handout. If you ever want to see it without a link, just Google Nursing Home Report Card Minnesota and it'll come up on top. At the bottom of the pages of the report card, there's a bunch of links, and one of them is to a technical user guide, and that'll give you some history as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Baker, we will be doing a little bit more focus on workforce later this session as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Held?
So quality trend, actually I should have put a couple slides first. I'm going to reorder this as I go along. So you saw the quality measures. We are also looking at adding three quality measures over the next year or so. Family satisfaction. We've been doing family satisfaction surveys. We'd like to add that to the report card as a quality measure because we do believe that satisfaction of families is also an outcome of good care or not good care, rehospitalization, and discharge back to community. There's a number of strategies that we've pursued in order to move toward that vision of using the purchasing role to improve quality. The first is public disclosure, and here you have the link to the report card. Also the performance-based incentive payment program called PIP. And Lauren made a brief reference to that earlier. PIP is a program where it's a competitive program where facilities can get a rate adjustment associated with undertaking a prospective quality improvement project. It's very competitive, and but we've had about three quarters of all facilities in the state at some time or another over the last decade participate at least once in that program. We have a new program called QIP, the Quality Improvement Incentive Payment Program. And under QIP, facilities will annually choose a quality improvement topic. They can look at their report card and they can pick any one of the quality of life domains or any one of the quality indicators that are listed there. And we will give them data showing them exactly how they scored and what their improvement would have to be in order to get a financial incentive to the maximum level. And that program began last April 1st with The first quality improvement performance period, which will end this March 31st, and by that time they will have selected their second goal. We will then, on October 1st of this year, implement a rate adjustment for each facility based on how well they performed relative to that goal. All facilities in the state have chosen to participate in this program, with only three exceptions. So with that mix of quality improvement strategies, I didn't talk about the quality add-on, the last one, which was used a few times. This gives you a sense of the trend of quality from the beginning of 2006 up through the beginning of 2013. And you'll see that there is and this is just looking at the QIs, the quality indicators, but there's really a pretty substantial trend toward improvement. And interestingly, any facility that has participated in PIP, their average has improved at a somewhat faster rate. Last topic I want to talk about is rebalancing, and this refers to getting the right mix of services in long-term care between institutional and home and community-based services. Why would we be interested in this? Well, a number of reasons. One, consumers would prefer to stay in their own homes. It's a more efficient use of our financial and human resources in most cases. Historically, Minnesota was overbedded. Back in the early 80s, for example, or mid-80s, we were one of the four or five most heavily bedded states in the country in terms of nursing home beds per 1,000 elderly. And somewhat of a goal of this, but also somewhat of a outcome of the strategies that we've adopted here, has to do with the financial viability of the industry and providing some financial incentives for taking unneeded beds out of service. So how has this rebalancing been accomplished? Back in the early 80s, there was a moratorium. No new beds can be added in Minnesota. We added pre-admission screening, the elderly waiver program, the alternative care program. In early 2000s, the legislature enacted a program to allow facilities to put beds in layaway. So a bed's a valuable asset. You don't want to just close it. It's kind of a scary step for a provider. By allowing a layaway program, they put the bed in the bank. They can have it back for 10 years. So the decision to do it can be a more gradual decision. They can test it and see how it works. If demand for those beds increases, then they can put it back in service as long as it's still in layaway. We created the plan closure program in, I believe, 2002. And under that program, if a bed is permanently closed, there's a financial incentive provided to the facilities. By the way, layaway also has some financial incentives. They do not have to pay the surcharge. Property rates are recalculated to reflect the same costs over fewer beds. And then in about 2005, the legislature enacted the single bed incentive. If a bed is permanently closed in a way that creates a new single bed, there's another financial incentive on top of the layaway and plan closure financial incentives. A couple years ago, the state began to operate a program called Return to Community, looking primarily at private paying people who are new in the nursing home. They've been there for 60 days, but less than 90, and have expressed an interest in returning back to the community. So under this program, they're offered assistance to do that if at the time a worker meets with them and they still want that assistance. And then finally, Minnesota is operating a program called Moving Home Minnesota, a Money Follows the Person program. How many beds does Minnesota have? This graph is showing you the beds per 1,000, 85 and older. And what you'll notice is that somewhere around 2011, we actually crossed the line and have the same or fewer beds per 1,000 as the U.S. overall. The red line is Minnesota, so it gives you a sense of how overbedded Minnesota was, and that both the U.S. and Minnesota have a declining number of beds per 1,000, Minnesota at a steeper slope. And finally, utilization. I think this is a really, really telling graph. Back in 1984, if you were 65 or older, you had an 8.4 percent risk of being in a nursing home. If you were 85 or older, a 36.4% risk. In other words, 36% of all people 85 and older were in a nursing home back then. That has now gone down to 14%. That's almost a two-thirds reduction. For the 65-plus population also, from 8.4 to 3.7%. So with that, I would take any questions if there are any.
We have a couple of minutes for questions. Does anyone have anything for Mr. Held? Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's more of a comment than a question. I share Representative Baker's concerns, I guess, about retention, and for me it's personal. My mother has been in a facility for dementia for a little over 2 years, well, about 2.5 years now, and I have seen kind, caring, compassionate staff turn over quite rapidly, and it appears to me that in a lot of cases, it's because, frankly, they're concerned about feeding their own children. And that bothers me a lot, that these people that are so nice to my mother at the same time are concerned about how their children are going to be fed. So that's just a comment that might be a quality issue that we could look at is, how are the staff living? If they're content and they have a livable wage, I would think the quality of care would be much better. The other comment that I would like to make on the rebalancing, consumers do prefer to stay in their home. And I believe that in Mankato, we have a program that maybe we could have a presentation from sometime. It is the Volunteer Interfaith Network effort, VINE. It's a faith-based organization. They get a tremendous... they have a tremendous program in Mankato that helps seniors stay in their home.
So. Okay, thank you. Anything, Mr. Held?
Sure, Mr. Chair. If I may, I would just comment that we feel that workforce is a huge issue, more so now with the economy doing better. This industry is very countercyclical. When the economy is doing bad, we don't have money to pay them more, but the labor market is friendly to them, not so much anymore. And I don't know for sure, but I suspect if you asked your providers or their trade associations, they'd say workforce is a big issue as well.
Thank you. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have two observations. We've got the facilities for senior housing in my district, for instance, and recently a young woman was working in one of them, but eventually she left just because she knew she wasn't providing the adequate care that she thought was needed. And I'm just wondering, how do we, other than the fact that you have the statistics showing that there is turnover, and what can we do to change that? And then also in another facility, there was a woman living who had some serious problems, but she did go to the ombudsman, and that is changing. And I'm assuming those types of things you can track quite readily. If you know a facility is having problems, then they go to the ombudsman.
Mr. Held?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do talk often with the ombudsman, the office on the same floor that my division office is on. We work well together. And on that issue, I guess I would want to comment that, you've got roughly 50, 60,000 human beings taking care of, roughly 30,000 human beings, and human beings make mistakes, and human beings all have different character, and bad things do happen, and problems arise where people kind of rub the wrong way against each other, and they need to resolve that. That's what the ombudsman is there to help with. There's also, the health department operating an inspection process, which is an annual visit. That's pretty in-depth, looking at what's going on in the facility and reflected as well in the report card. And there's the Office of Health Facility Complaints at the health department. where if somebody has an issue going on in a nursing home, they need to contact OHFC and ask them for help with that issue. So there's a lot of and those are the strategies that come to mind. In terms of, you asked a question earlier in your comment about, you know, what can we do about the turnover. I'm a little hesitant to go too deep into that with my assistant commissioner sitting next to me, but I would comment that the ability to pay a higher wage is probably quite related to the ability to retain an employee when people are leaving because more lucrative opportunities come along. When a nurse gets offered $10,000 or $15,000 a year more to come work somewhere else, I don't know how many people in this room would turn that type of an opportunity down. And yet, we did an analysis a few years ago as part of a governor's workforce or healthcare task force that had a workforce component. And to bring nursing home RNs, LPNs, certified nursing assistants, and therapeutic medication aides up to par with their peers in hospitals, the cost to the state share of Medicaid was over $100 million. So what can you do about it? Well, you're the ones who are going to write the budget this year, and that's going to have an appropriation in it. So if you need help to figure out some solutions to that, I'm available to provide technical assistance. I'm sure others in the room would like to do so as well. There's a number of approaches that can be taken to this.
Thank you, Mr. Held. Anything else, Representative Mason?
Nothing.
Okay, thank you. Representative Miller?
No. Okay.
All right, Representative Rosenthal?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Held. First, would it be possible to get a copy of this electronically? Because it's pretty much impossible to read on the sheets that we have.
Oh, no.
With all the numbers.
I put six on a page because I thought it was, well, partly I was being selfish. I didn't want to carry 400 pieces of paper.
No, I understand.
I believe the committee has it electronically.
Yes, it's on the committee website.
Okay, great. Rosenthal. Sorry about that. Second, I'm looking back at this comparison of PC1 rates and quality scores. And it seems to me that the nonprofits, whether Metro or non-Metro, have much better quality outcomes than government or for-profit. And I was wondering if you could comment on why you think that is.
Mr. Held.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I wouldn't ask you to draw a sort of statistical conclusion off of this table because we arbitrarily picked eight facilities. And we picked them to demonstrate the point that the relationship between quality and rate is weak. We're not so sure that it should be a weak relationship. We think that, well, let me speak somewhat for myself, that we should be willing to pay more for nursing home care if we're getting better quality, but only then. At somewhat of a risk, I'm going to characterize what the full set of data would look like. If we created for you, and we've done this in the past, I haven't done it in a few years, if we created a scattergram, which would be a graph with a dot for every nursing home placed at the intersection of its rate and its quality score, it would, and you looked at that on the screen, it would look like somebody sneezed on the screen. There is no relationship. In testimony a few years ago, I was challenged about that because obviously if you did it by geographic group, you'd get a different finding that the geography is confounding it. We ran it by geographic group, saw the same thing. Whether there's a statistically significant relationship between quality score and ownership type, I can't speak to that right now. We could look into that.
Thank you, Mr. Held. Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Held, back to the retention rates. When you give us the information on retention rates, can you break that down by people who make, say, less than $15 an hour and those who make more than $15 an hour? And also, can you compare those retention rates with other industries so that we've got something to work with as to how nursing homes compare with other industries when it comes to retention?
Mr. Held.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe that we can give you the breakdown of retention rates by position, and we can give you the average wage by position. I don't think I would have a data set rich enough to give me every one of the 50,000 employees and how much they're making and what their retention is. I'm quite sure I don't have that data. In terms of comparing it with other industries, we would have to look to Deed to see if they have comparison data, and we will do that.
All right. Mr. Chair, one more question.
Representative Newton.
On your quality indicators, Mr. Held, does that include the veterans nursing homes?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the report card does not include any of the nursing homes that are not in the MA program. The veterans homes are not in the MA program.
Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as you were going through the presentation, which thank you very much, was very helpful and informative, I was making a lot of notes about questions that I had, and I'm just going to try to hit a few of them because maybe I can talk to you offline about some others. But just going back to some of your slides here, the one about industry financial performance, I'd like to see something like that in terms of types of ownership. That would be helpful to me, but I wanted to ask you what it means on this slide that these facilities lost money, and if they, you know, lost money in the sense that we think of businesses losing money, what made up the difference for them? Because, you know, I assume that most of them are still afloat, or are we talking about people that actually went under? So that's my first question, if you could.
Mr. Held.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling. It felt like several questions, but I'm going to try to address it. You'll call me on it if I didn't, please. We can do this by, we don't have to do it by ownership type. I've got that with me, and I can just tell you the answer to that, I think. I thought I had it with me. So the comparable data for 2013 is that the for-profits, Didn't I have that in here? Ownership type. Yeah, I did have that in here. You do have that slide.
Right. We have the breakout by ownership type. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. But we don't have this same data about financial performance by ownership type. That's what I'm saying.
That's what, if you look at chart, I believe it's slide 22. This is telling you the total net gain loss by ownership type. So cumulatively, the not-for-profit facilities in 2013 lost about $6 or $7 million, $7.2 million.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
So some of them made money. In fact, 54% made money that year, but the ones who lost money apparently lost more than the ones who made.
Okay.
All right, and Representative Lee, I would just remind the committee that we do have some providers who traveled a ways today. I'm sure Mr. Held would be glad to come back to if we have more in-depth questions for him later on. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, in light of that, I'll just ask him just some clarifying stuff that's a little short so that I understand what he's got here on the page. So, Mr. Held, in your payer mix, what is the other category? Is that long-term care insurance mainly? It was like 9%.
We have struggled to get a handle on the 9.2% other, and it's grown. It's much bigger than it used to be. It consists mostly of managed care contracts, and it's either managed care Medicare days or managed care Medicaid type days for Medicaid enrollees who are duly eligible and in a managed care plan. A few years ago, we tried collecting data on that, and the facilities basically they didn't have good enough data to report it to us with enough accuracy that it was worth going through the exercise.
Representative Liebling.
Okay, thank you. And then finally, Mr. Held, can you just give us the ballpark overall cost to our budget of funding nursing home care? If you have that, just so we can kind of keep the context of what we're talking about.
Dang, here. I should have put that in here. It's the state share is about $775 million. We can give you an exact figure. I'm sorry, that's the Medicaid. The total Medicaid is about $775 million, and state share is roughly half of that. And so it's just under $400 million.
Representative Liebling.
Mr. Chair, is that a two-year number or a one-year number?
That's an annual.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the quality indicators detail, and if we were to start paying based on quality indicators, I'm afraid we might run into some disincentives to accept some patients. Similarly, you know, to the concern there was for the overall pay rates. Specifically, I'm thinking of our own family's experience. My dad had ataxia, and he would have caused his facility to get a lower mark on 5 out of those quality indicators because it's a degenerative condition, and so a lot of these are conditioned on maintaining or improving mobility and whatnot, and his was steadily degrading. So how do we guard against that? I mean, do we need to add a little more detail into these quality indicators? Is it actually already there, but it just doesn't show up in this table, or what do we do about that?
Mr. Held.
Mr. Chair, Representative Yaruso. In fact, and I didn't talk about it because I had a lot less time than I've actually taken, but these measures are risk adjusted. So we look at a whole bunch of factors that are specific to each one of these quality indicators, and what we say is, given that factor, what would you expect? What is the norm of that finding, given that this person has a certain diagnosis or another diagnosis? So, for example, a couple of these look at pain. Well, we take into consideration cancer. If a person has cancer, one expects pain. So that's statistically adjusted for through risk adjustment.
Thank you.
There's probably no perfect risk adjustment, but we work very hard on getting that as good as we can get it.
And we will be talking about quality a little bit further when we have the department back in to talk about their long-term care report in a later hearing. So with that, I'd like to thank Assistant Commissioner Coleman and Mr. Held for their presentation today, a six-hour presentation that they were able to fit in 45 minutes. Very much appreciate that. Next, we're going to hear some testimony on the rate setting that we have from the long-term care providers across the state. And to begin, we have members of the Long-Term Care Imperative, Patty Cullen and Gail Kvenvold.
So. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Gail Kvenvold, and I'm the president and CEO of Leading Age Minnesota. You previously knew us as Aging Services of Minnesota, and with me today is Patty Cullen from Care Providers of Minnesota, and together we are the advocacy partnership that's known as the Long-Term Care Imperative. I can't tell you how excited we are for the opportunity to come before you as a committee and how pleased we are that the Committee on Aging and Long-Term Care exists so that we can do that deeper dive into these issues of the aging of our state. We look forward to working with each and every one of you to plan for the needs of our seniors. Last week, we know that you heard from the state demographer and you heard all of the statistics about our growing older population, 60,000 new seniors every year in Minnesota for a long way out into the future, more seniors than school-aged children by the year 2020, just the end of this decade. And what I would like to also mention is that this week, the School of Public Health at the University of Minnesota released a new study that demonstrates that about 70% of those seniors are going to need some type of long-term care service during their lives. And for about half of them, that's going to mean a stay in a nursing home, albeit for a shorter length of time, as Mr. Held covered in his report. And also, the majority of those seniors aren't aware that they are going to have those needs and haven't really given a lot of thought to how they will pay for those needs when they do have them. With that demand for services, we are indeed going to need more quality caregivers. And as you will hear from the providers here this morning, that really has taken center stage in terms of the challenges that face providers of older adult services in Minnesota. We're delighted by the ideas that have already been brought forward and really look forward to working with you on that. And of course, we also agree that we need to fund a full continuum of services for seniors. We all want to stay at home as long as possible. And while it's important to support nursing homes in our communities, that isn't at the exclusion of assisted living or adult day or home care or those vital services that keep us independent as long as possible. And finally, I would just say we also look forward to working with you on how we will reform how we pay for services in our state around the central principles of making caregiving itself an honored and sought-after profession, ensuring that seniors have access to services wherever they live in our state, and planning ahead as much as possible, as much as we can, for our own long-term care needs. You have a tough job in front of you. We know we are in good hands. We pledge our support to work with you in every way possible, and we're confident that working together we can indeed meet these challenges of our aging state.
Thank you, and I'm Patty Cullen. I'm the CEO of Care Providers in Minnesota, and I'm going to keep my words really short because you've had kind of a brain dump at the start of this committee, and I feel your pain. It took me 25 years to understand Bob Held's presentation, so to expect you to do it in 45 minutes is a near impossible task. So my good job is to highlight kind of why we all care, why we're in this profession, why you have this committee. We have a variety of principles that we have been using to develop some reform proposals you're going to hear later this year or later this session. We all want seniors to remain in a place they call home for as long as they can. We all want seniors to stay at home whenever they possibly can. We all want to fully fund what we believe is needed for good quality care. We all want to invest in caregiving as a long-term profession because it is a profession and we need good quality caregivers. We all want families to be prepared and to be able to get ready financially and emotionally for whatever happens at the end stage of their loved ones' lives. So I want to leave you with a video. We have a new statewide campaign we kicked off yesterday called Face Aging Minnesota. We spent some time at a continuing campus in Woodbury several weeks ago talking to a lot of the seniors there and have a lovely portrait of Helen. And we just wanted you to go back to the real reason why we're all here talking about the issue of aging. And hopefully you can hear this. I flunked AV.
I was 5'5", and I'm only 4'9 now, so I've lost all that, and I was about 137 pounds, and I'm 98 now, so not much of me left, but what's left is still kind of feisty. In the last couple of years, I've written a story about my 3 years in the service. The best thing I did was I was sent overseas to England and ended up at 8th Fighter Command headquarters. And I was right in the thick of things during the invasion of Europe. Anything that the enemy sent over London, if it got through there, it went over us too. And we were in constant air raid situation. So it was quite interesting. And I was only 22 at the time, so I didn't realize I was making history, which I do now. I do understand that now. But I try to keep busy, and I like to play, I play poker with the boys. And unfortunately, we have a lot of people now that don't want to come out. And I had one gal say, I asked her what she does. Well, I sit on my balcony and I count the cars that go by. And when I get to 50, I start over again. And to me, that's wasting your life. You should be enjoying yourself as much as you can. This summer, I caught a 31-inch northern, and I pulled it up to the boat myself, and we took a picture of it, but he didn't want to clean it, so we threw it back. That was a memorable experience. Actually, most of my life has been pretty memorable to me.
We also have with us today Mark Anderson and Tom Pollock.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mark Anderson. I'm the president and CEO of Knute & Elson in Alexandria, Minnesota, and chair-elect of Leading Age Minnesota. I'm joined by Tom Pollock, the administrator of Park River States in Coon Rapids and the chair of Care Providers. I really want to thank you for giving us the opportunity to testify. I also want to thank you for creating the Committee on Aging. I think it is very important that this committee has been created to address one of the most important issues of the state of Minnesota. How do we care for our aging population? You've just met Helen in the video. She has lived life to the fullest and continues to thrive each day while receiving the care she needs. Tom and I are lucky, because we get the privilege of caring for hundreds of seniors that are as unique as Helen each year. But our job has gotten significantly tougher as our organizations struggle to recruit and retain caregivers needed to provide quality care. We need a reformed system to help us address our workforce shortages so that we can continue to provide care for seniors like Helen. In the past few years, my organization has struggled to recruit people to fill our job openings. We have difficulty providing our staff competitive and fair wages and benefits. We regularly have 50 openings throughout our continuum of care. We especially find difficulty recruiting direct caregivers such as nurses and nursing assistants. We have found with approximately 3.3% unemployment in our county that there are more opportunities with employers who have the ability to pay their staff market-adjusted wages and benefits. We lose qualified staff to retail stores like Fleet Farm and the hospitals where they are being better paid or work in less strenuous conditions. We are limited at providing wage increases or cost of living increases due to the current reimbursement system. The work of our staff has significant regulations, which is stressful in addition to the increased complexity of care they tender. What's more is recruiting and retaining compassionate caregivers who share our organizational values. We have responded by suspending admissions at time to turn seniors and their families away from our care center because we lack staff to care for those seniors. It is not uncommon to send referrals 60 to 90 miles away for care. Seniors have often built, formed, and shaped their communities, and now at the end of their lives, the most critical stage perhaps, they're being turned away because we do not have adequate staffing levels to serve them. On October 1st, 2014, we made the difficult decision to cut beds to reduce our capacity from 108 beds to 85 beds, knowing it would create access issues for those who needed care. Our local board of directors and staff struggled with this. Knute & Elson originated in 1948 as a social ministry organization and was founded to respond to the needs of our community with appropriate care for seniors. We grapple regularly with the balancing of turning away seniors who need care, ensuring our ability to provide quality care that our customers expect as a Knute Nelson client, and our financial commitments such as fair wages and benefits. This creates a huge problem. We shouldn't have to send seniors away from their communities when they need care. We should be able to pay our staff competitive wages and benefits. I guarantee you, I know they work for that. We need to find better solutions to the current operating environment and the challenges that providers and ultimately Minnesotans are saddled with.
Thank you, Mark. As Mark stated, I'm Tom Pollack, the administrator at Park River Estates Care Center and chair of care providers. I've been in the profession for 33 years and at my current position for 15. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mark did a great job of describing how difficult it is to recruit caregivers into our settings. However, it's not just a rural problem. My organization struggles with recruitment as well. But I want to take a moment to describe the challenges we face in retaining good caregivers once we are successful at recruiting them. Senior care settings are often the training grounds for new nurses. Recent data shows that senior care providers throughout Minnesota hire the vast majority of new graduates from nursing programs. But within 18 months, most of the nurses have left the long-term care settings and have gone to a more lucrative hospital job. The long-term care imperative estimates that a hospital registered nurse makes nearly $35,000 more a year than an RN in a senior care setting. For my organization, that means constant turnover. Since 2004, I actually experienced the highest amount of turnover in 2014. In 2014 alone, we had 20 nursing assistants and 6 registered nurses leave for actually, and they told us, higher paying jobs. That was an increase of 85% turnover in just 5 years. While the numbers are startling, the biggest impact is on the people that we are trying to serve. Constant turnover means that the staff don't really know our residents, and they can't really give those special details that can make care extraordinary. As you can see, we are already making tough choices, and the explosion from demand from the baby boomers hasn't yet been felt. This is a tough challenge, but I believe we can meet the challenge. But we need to all agree that all senior Minnesotans deserve quality care, not just the ones who got in line first. I urge you to make reforming our reimbursement system a priority this session so that we can provide the quality care that Helen and thousands of other Minnesota seniors deserve today and into the future. In a society that celebrates youth, it's time to face aging. Thank you.
Mr. Pollack and Mr. Anderson, thank you for your testimony today. We'll move right into the testimony from other providers throughout the state. If you could please identify yourself when you come up and tell us where you're from for the record, that would be great. We'll start with Bruce Glanzer.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bruce Glanzer, and I'm the president and CEO of Good Shepherd Community in Sauk Rapids. Good Shepherd has a full continuum of lung care services, from very independent living in patio homes and apartments to home care, to assisted living, to cottages serving adults with Alzheimer's, to nursing home and subacute care. We serve approximately 625 people daily. When fully staffed, we employ about 370 employees. I've been an administrator licensed in Minnesota and South Dakota for the past 37 years in multiple settings. While I've seen some difficult economic times over the years, the last 6 years have been more difficult than the previous 31 all put together. Since the Great Recession of 2008 and the state's budget for shortfalls, the cuts and freezes to older adult services have come home to roost. The current rates set by the state have very little relationship to the actual cost of providing the care, and it's been that way for about 15 years. In the first 2 years since 2008, we were somewhat able to absorb the freezes and cuts without dire outcomes. But then the laws changed, Affordable Care Act came into play, and our health care premiums were projected to increase 15 to 20% yearly. We were forced to change deductibles, co-pays, and out-of-pocket expenses. And even with those, we still see increases of 9 to 10% per year. The next wave of struggle at this point is, and the greatest problem we face, is workforce issues. Because of the freezes and cuts, we did not have the revenues available to us to adjust wages as other businesses do. Other businesses are able to simply increase the price of the goods and services they produce to pay their wages they need to. We're unable to do so since the legislature determines the rates we charge for our services. But that brief introduction, I give you some statistics about Good Shepherd in terms of turnover and open positions. In 2012, our average company turnover, that includes both the nursing home and our home and community-based services, we turned over 55% of our employees. In just the nursing component in 2012, RNs turned over at 40%, LPNs 65%, and the AIDS 76%. In 2013, the average company was 56%, kind of stayed stable. The RNs went to 56%, the LPNs stayed decreased to 53%, and our nursing assistants went to 79%, 3% increase from the prior year. In 2014, the company average went to 64% turnover, with an increase of 8% over 2013. The RNs turnover increased to 65%. The LPN stayed stable at 53, but our nursing assistants jumped over 100%. Think about that, 100% turnover. Currently, as of Monday, I have 51 open positions in my organization. 40 of them are part-time, 11 are full-time. That equates to approximately 36 FTEs. We have 4 RN positions open, 4 LPN positions open, 42 nursing assistant positions open, and 1 cook's position. I'd like to share a real quick story with you. Back in February of 2014, toward the end of February, my DON came into my office with her ADON and said, Bruce, kind of should have put the schedule out for March. And I said, well, why not? And she said, well, here, I need to show you something. And she showed me her March schedule, and there were over 240 open shifts on that schedule. And she was scared. My staff picked them up. The people I had, they worked double shifts. They worked 21, I had one staff member work 21 straight days in a row to cover our shifts. That's the dilemma we're facing in long-term care. While the numbers I've shared for our organization are scary, this is pretty much the standard in facilities in Minnesota today. The turnover and workforce issues are the same whether we're talking about the nursing home or whether we're in the home and community-based services sector. We are not unique in that situation. There are several other factors that have affected our health, our financial health, and our labor market. As some of I've mentioned before, we are no longer competitive with other industries such as hotels, fast food, restaurants, grocery stores, for entry-level positions. Hospitals pay RNs an average of $15 to $18 an hour more. LPNs are paid probably $8 to $10 an hour more, and our aides are paid $5 to $6 an hour more. The overall cost of operations in our organizations have increased dramatically. The Accountable Care Act, liability insurance, food costs, services of mechanical companies, etc., have all gone up. We have seen large increases without additional rate increases as they are passing their health care costs and operational increases onto us for their goods and services. Another thing that comes into play is the minimum wage increase passed last year. While DHS provided us with a calculator to determine our share of the kind of the tiers that we have, over the 3 years, that calculator showed we get a minimum, or we'd get a total of $55,000 to address that. The complexity of the calculator requires many hours to complete it, and the amount it provided does not adequately cover the disparity between the entry-level minimum wage positions and a nurse aide position, which requires a certification, not to mention how it affects the compression of other positions in our organization. The current system is broken and severely limits our ability to fulfill our mission and values. As a Christian organization, our first calling is to serve older adults in the community with respect, trust, service, and compassion. The current system will not and will hinder us from carrying out our mission now and in the foreseeable future if something dramatically isn't done. Over the past 6 years, the rate freezes and cuts have put providers in a very difficult position. While the revenue has been decreased or has been stable or frozen, our expenses have gone up, but not a single regulation has been deleted. Yesterday, the Long-Term Care Imperative launched a bold new reform proposal that will not only give providers a rate increase this year, but sets the stage for the state and us providers to serve the needs of our older adults through the demographic shift we're all experiencing. I'm here today to ask that the legislature adopt that new reform proposal from the Long-Term Care Associations. Minnesota needs to finally get away from the old reimbursement yo-yo system. And by that I mean we're the yo-yo, the legislature's the string, and pulled us up and down every year based upon economic situations in our state. We need a stable reimbursement system that supports the services older adults want and deserve. With the demographics coming in Minnesota, the funding for older adult services must become a priority in this legislative session. The longer you wait, the longer we wait, the greater the pain in the future. So as our society ages, we have a responsibility to meet the needs of those caring, coming to our facilities. It may be your dad or your mom or your grandparent, and yes, maybe even someday you or I. And I want to be cared for with the dignity and respect, and most of all, with compassion. So please help me and other providers to meet their growing needs by supporting our proposal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Glanzer. And for any members who might have any questions, we'll try to hold those off until the end and have all the providers here for answers there. Next, we have Cammie Peterson-DeVries.
Hi, and good morning, Chair and committee members. Thank you so much for having us on this passionate issue. I really appreciate the stories that we heard over here and the compassion and passion for this, because it is what it's about. I'm an administrator, and I'm also a registered nurse. And the story that we have is more about the story of taking care of people. Last Christmas, we actually had fundraising done so that Santa could bring gifts to our residents. We took that money and gave it to our staff to go out and purchase gifts for the residents that they took care of. We have consistent assignments, so it was very, very easy for them. When we looked around, the residents were happy. They said, you know, we didn't even know that Santa knew us so well, because they got things that were personal, things that were about them. But you know what? 6 out of 10 of those caregivers are going to be gone next year with our turnover rate. And what does that really do? And how long does it take then for us to replace them and to get that same commitment and that same quality? And that is the concern. It's about taking care of people. So when we have that many people being turned and have that much turnover, where they can go to the sugar beet plant down the road and make $2 to $4 more an hour and have better health insurance than what we can provide, they're going to leave us. Their cost of living increases, and the amount that we can pay them does not. The amount that we're reimbursed does not even increase for us to cover the cost of our groceries going up for the facility. We don't see those kind of increases that we need. You know, we as a facility have taken a commitment to try to retain our employees. We have tried to think outside the box, do innovative things. We have kids come on and off the school bus, and we do kids programming with our residents to help defray the cost of before and after care for our staff members. We do a kids club on days where school is off so that they don't have the cost of daycare that day. Those are things we also offer where we can, our staff can buy meal items and take home. They can buy through our company, they can also purchase groceries. We do all those things, and yet we still have that type of turnover. And it really is about the cost of living and them having a livable wage. I went to them and I said that I was going to be here today and ask what they wanted you to hear. and this is what they said. Low wages results in higher turnover, staff dissatisfaction, and lower quality care for residents. We have problems with making our bills. We need more. Health insurance is something we cannot afford. We work less hours for our kids and myself to have health insurance because Minnesota will help them with that. So they work less to have health insurance because we can't give it to them. They said, we like our residents and we want to be able to afford to stay here. And we have to ask ourselves, what are the incentives for long-term care staff? Often we are the training ground for people and then they move on. If you move forward with the new proposed payment system, we would increase our rates at our facility by at least 16%. This equates to approximately $1,900 a day. This would greatly improve our ability to staff. Just like our staff, when food costs increase, we have no method of making up the difference. Our staff can, and many will, find a better paying job. The facility cannot. The only method to improve our financial situation is with increasing our rates and decreasing the disparity of reimbursement. Change in the reimbursement will positively impact our caregivers, improve quality, and provide us with the opportunity to be reimbursed based on our costs. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Peterson-DeVries. Mr. Silty.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, hello and good morning. My name is Mike Silty, and I work as a nursing home administrator at Westwind Village in Morris. I'd like to thank you for allowing me to be with you this morning to shed some light on West Central Minnesota. The biggest issue that we're facing because of the current nursing home reimbursement system is our ability to recruit and retain nursing staff. It's next to impossible. Our biggest competitor in Morris is the local hospital, which is only a few blocks away. There's a huge wage gap that exists between our employees and theirs. Starting wage for a certified nursing assistant at Westwind Village is $10.55 an hour. At the hospital, it's $11.59 an hour, so right around or over a dollar. For LPNs at Westwind Village, we start those employees at $14.95. At the hospital, it's $17.79, so almost a $3 an hour difference. And for registered nurses, we start our registered nurses at $21.75, and at the hospital, it's $29.73, so about $8 an hour difference. So, as you can imagine, when the hospital does have an opening, we're bound to lose one of our employees. The workforce today, we found, has no loyalty to their employer. A certified nursing assistant today looks a lot different and acts a lot different than one from 10 years ago. We found that no matter how long they've been employed by us, the employees go where the money is. There's also a huge decline in demographics in our part of the state. There aren't the people moving into West Central Minnesota. We have a manufacturing plant in town that could hire 150 plus employees today just to meet their current demands. So what does this all mean for us? Today, as I sit here, we have 15 full-time equivalent openings just for direct care nursing staff out of a total of 50. That's 30% of our shifts being covered by overtime hours, by mandating our current employees to stay an extra 4 or 8 hours a day, and our staff are tired of it. They're burned out from having to pick up extra hours. They're tired from working long days and stressed out because they fear we're headed down this road for the long haul. Rising costs in food, nursing supplies, and utilities have gotten us in the red. Just think what would happen if you asked the local grocery store to operate at a loss. They would likely close their doors, raise their prices. We're the only nursing home in Stevens County, and so closing is not an option. Minnesota is also an equalization of rate state, so our private pay people cannot be charged more than the medical assistance people. So I'll wrap up by saying we just need to provide a livable wage for our caregivers. Our current rate structure does not care for our residents and staff, and a new reimbursement system will help. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Silty. Ms. Friedland?
Yep, that's correct. Thank you.
Thanks.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I am an administrator and also a registered nurse at a northern facility, 44 beds, up in Aiken, Minnesota. I just am going to add to what Cammy and Mike and everyone else has said. Zero, that's the number of applicants who have applied for a nursing assistant job in the past 3 months at Aiken Health Services. We've not had one applicant come through the door. And we have tried, social media, you name it, from phone apps to smart recruiter to whatever, but zero. Zero is the number of applicants. 56, again, I'm a 44-bed facility, is the number of open nursing assistant shifts in a two-week pay period. We're not even speaking to the skilled nursing side. $2.50 more an hour is the amount the local hospital will pay for a nursing assistant compared to what we can. 5 is the number of full-time nursing assistants that left my facility to go work for them. Same duties, same job, same local area, but that's where the money was. 1 is the number of qualified nursing assistant who actually declined a job at our facility to stay at the Dairy Queen. Our caregivers can't afford to work, and we can't afford to pay them. We've had one employee recently, even at gas prices today, who couldn't afford to come to work, let alone her shifts, or pick up any because, she couldn't afford gas. We've actually had 2 employees that reduced their hours so that they could stay on their county benefits. Last year, I had a great discussion with Senator Carrie Rood, and she thanked me for being a nurse and working for the elderly and told me it was a calling. But for $5,000, $10,000 more a year, where's your calling? Aiken Health Services, the local attached nursing home, or the Dairy Queen? 35 is the number of years I've had the privilege to work in long-term care, from nursing assistant to administrator. And 0 is the number of times I've seen our crisis at the level we're at. Don't leave long-term care and aging to luck. Most people say they're not going to a nursing home, but 70% of Americans over the age of 65 will have to see us at least once in their lifetime. You might not get to stay till the end of your time, but you might need our services. A new reimbursement system will help, but we still need to look at other solutions to solving our workforce crisis. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Friedland. Next, we have the Courage County Rehabilitation Institute here with us, and Representative Freiberg is also here to help them with their testimony today. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record and present.
Representative, Chair, and Committee, good morning, and thank you for your time today. My name is Matt Kinney. I'm the Director at Courage Kinney Rehab Institute and the Administrator at the Transitional Rehab Program in Golden Valley. The Transitional Rehab Program is a 44-bed facility licensed as a skilled nursing facility that includes rate equalization. From its beginnings as a residence for younger adults with disabilities, the TRP has grown into one of the leading specialized subacute transitional programs in the country. We serve some of the state's most complex medical cases with centers of excellence in serving individuals who have suffered a traumatic brain injury, spinal cord injury, and other complex neurological condition. To meet the needs of the individuals served, our program includes services not possible in a typical skilled nursing facility, including complex medical management and intense and specialized rehabilitation. Guided by our vision that one day all people will live, work, learn, and play in a community based on abilities and not disabilities, the TRP is proud of the outcomes our clients have achieved, including 88% of individuals served that are able to return to their community or another community-based setting, and at a higher level of function and independence that otherwise would not be possible without our program. As you will see in the handout that we provided, in 2013, we served patients from 47 counties across the state. As a safety net for the state's most complex cases, there is no other facility in Minnesota or the region that serves the population we do with the treatment and services we have the ability to provide. We were before the legislature because we were very concerned about our ability to maintain this critical statewide asset without help mitigating our unsustainable losses, which topped $1.4 million in 2013. I want to take this opportunity to introduce Dr. Heidi Street, who is here today to share a little bit more about our work at the Transitional Rehab Program.
Good morning, and thank you to Chairman Schumacher and representatives for this opportunity to come and speak with you today. My name is Dr. Heidi Street. I'm the Medical Director at the Transitional Rehab Program and also the Advanced Primary Care Clinic on the Courage Kenny Golden Valley campus. I'm also a Medical Director of a large skilled nursing facility that focuses on the more traditional geriatric population. Imagine with me for a moment that your morning is not going as planned. You're late, you're trying to get to a hearing, and you're 20 minutes late. It snowed. You're coming from Wilmer, Cottage Grove, Sleepy Eye, wherever in the state you call home, and you hit a patch of ice at highway speed. You lose control of your car. You hit a concrete median, and your car rolls several times before coming to rest. The highway patrol, paramedics, ER doctors, trauma surgeons do their best, and you survive. You've suffered a traumatic brain injury, multiple fractures, internal injuries, and a cervical spinal cord injury. You cannot move or feel anything below your collarbones. You speak and swallow with great difficulty. Your ability to retain information and remember and problem solve have been greatly impaired. You need two people and a mechanical lift to get you in and out of bed, and you cannot control your bodily functions. This scenario is not unusual, and it's where we begin at the Transitional Rehab Program. The saying, "it takes a village," really applies to what happens at the TRP and this team of rehab specialists. In the TRP, we have therapists in physical, occupational, and speech therapy who have subspecialty training in dealing with people with spinal cord, traumatic brain injury, and complex stroke. This is so that we can provide the services needed so that each client can obtain their highest level of recovery and independence. Physical medicine and rehabilitation physicians direct the complex rehab care and treat the unique complications associated with these conditions, such as spasticity, cognitive impairment, neurogenic bowel and bladder. Primary care physicians and nurse practitioners focus on medical needs like infection, wound management, diabetes, hypertension, and heart disease. Psychologists, neuropsychologists, and psychiatry help clients and their families cope with this life-changing event, understanding how chemistry and the ability to process information in the brain have changed and how we move forward. As you can imagine, the nursing needs of these clients are great as well, and nursing and nursing assistants attend to medical, personal, emotional support needs while continuing the rehab plan of care developed by the therapy team. Not only are the therapy teams very specialized, but their therapy equipment and the adaptive technology utilized is not available for financial reasons in other skilled nursing facilities. Also, our length of stay is quite significantly longer, about 60 days as compared to a typical rehab stay in a traditional SNF at around 20 days. But by employing this specialized and completely necessary team, we're able to return nearly 90% of clients to a community setting and their highest level of independence. While expensive compared to a traditional skilled nursing facility, we're able to achieve these results at a quarter of the cost per day of an inpatient hospital setting. If our program did not exist, patients would have very limited options. Traditional nursing homes would be challenged to accept these patients given their care needs. And without our medical and rehab model, patients would regain less function and independence. At this time, there's no better person in the world to tell their story about their experience in TRP than someone who's been there. And I'm very pleased to introduce Molly Colstead.
Hi, Mr. Chair and Committee. My name is Molly Colstead, and my husband is Isaac Colstead. Isaac was a patient at the TRP. He was in an attack last May and suffered a traumatic brain injury. He was at the TRP for 3 months, where he received intense physical, occupational, speech therapy, as well as medical and psychological services. When Isaac arrived at the TRP, he was in a wheelchair, he was unable to communicate, and he was fed through a tube. There was little hope for recovery, but the TRP committed themselves and invested themselves in my husband's care to do everything that they could to make sure that he had the needs that he needed for our and our family to get through this. Today, because of the rehabilitation he received at Courage Kenny, my husband is home with me and our two little girls, walking under his own power and engaging in conversation over family dinners again. I am a nurse by background and can tell you from both my professional and personal experience that the TRP program is incredibly unique from traditional skilled nursing facilities. This is an aging meeting, and many of you have touched on the elderly. My husband and I are 24. We had an unforeseen trauma in our life and needed a program like the TRP in order to get through that and overcome it. Things like complex TBI cases like my husband's just come second nature to this program. The vast and specialized services that the TRP provided brought back Isaac, brought back my husband, and brought back my little girl's father, and they're back there. So the TRP has been incredibly beneficial to my Isaac's recovery. I hope you will support this legislation so the program can continue to benefit others like they did me. Thank you for this opportunity to speak today.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Colstead, and thank you for being so patient with our committee today and having such well-behaved children back there. Are there questions for any of the testifiers? Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think mine is, again, more of a statement than anything else. As a business owner out in Willmar, I have a restaurant and a hotel, and I know exactly what it's like, not to the level, of course, of our care that I do in our hotel business, but if we can't react to what is needed to our industry in the moment to keep employees, I don't know what I would do. And I can't imagine what you have gone through over the last several years. As a freshman legislator, I'm embarrassed that we allowed this to happen, and I can tell you that there's a reason the new committee has been formed, and I'm excited to say that I know there's going to be some really good reform coming, and I at least hope that you can go back to your facilities and say that help is on its way. I really believe that. As a business person, we have to give tools to our caring providers out here that are working every single day taking care of our seniors, and if that doesn't happen, then we shouldn't be in these seats. I am committed to that, and I just want you to know that I can't thank you enough for your dedication, and look forward to showing you some good movements on our end. So thank you all for coming.
Thank you, Representative Baker. Any other questions from community members? Okay, seeing none. I want to thank everyone for coming today, thank the department for their presentations, and to all the testifiers who made the long trip to come and speak with us today. I want to take a moment, too, for Chairman's prerogative to congratulate our committee administrator on 15 years of marriage that she is celebrating this week.
All right.
And also wanted to congratulate our Republican researcher, Chelsea Whitman, who is celebrating her 23 years on this earth today. And with that, we are adjourned.